Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello and welcome to the New Books Network. I'm your host, Jennifer Yeremeyeva, and today we have a fascinating book to consider. Professor Michael Hodorkovsky of Loyola University is with me to discuss his new book, Russia's 20th Century, A Journey in 100 Histories. In addition to Professor Hodorkovsky's distinguished academic career, he's also a very active and eloquent opinion contributor to the New York Times about matters related to Russia, so I'm sure we're going to have a very interesting discussion. Russia's 20th Century is a fascinating approach to dissecting the Soviet century, which I think is an exercise in frustration for academics and really a Sisyphean task for the layman. And that's where this thin but incredibly powerful book comes into play. Professor Hodorkovsky has taken a novel approach by crafting 100 vignettes, one for each year of the century. Each of them examines a very specific incident, be it in history, art, politics, science, current relations, or international relations. Taken separately, each is a very vivid and cogent window into the very strange world of the Soviet Union. But when one considers them as a whole, they present an incredibly compelling narrative, which allows us to consider the entire Soviet century from a fresh perspective. More importantly, I think several important themes come into the fore, which helps us to better understand the arc of this cruel century. I'm really looking forward to discussing these with Professor Hodorkovsky, and it gives me such great pleasure to welcome him to the podcast. Welcome, Professor Hodorkovsky.
Thank you, Jennifer. Pleasure to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you. Before we begin, I wonder if you could take our listeners through your academic background and how you came to the study of Russian history.
Well, I emigrated from the Soviet Union. The year was 1978 when I left the country. And I always wanted to study history since I was 17 or so. But in the Soviet Union, this was not an easy thing to do. You had to have connections. You had to have maybe be able to bribe someone. History departments were these privileged departments that essentially bred the communist elite. It was not just history teachers and history professors, but sort of like in the West, if you want to have a political career, you'll go to law school as a good jumping board, a path towards politics. That's what history did. In fact, even today, if you look at some politicians, many of them have history background. Some of them have law background as well. So, in fact, this was one of the reasons why I left the country. And when I came to the United States, in fact, it was Chicago, after doing all kind of menial jobs for a year, I decided I will try to do what I actually always wanted to do, despite various advice from likewise immigrants like myself who said, no, when you come to America, you have to make money. Why would you go into history? So eventually I decided, yes, that's exactly what I'll do. And I was lucky enough to be accepted at the University of Chicago. And this is where I went to graduate school. This is where I studied Russian history. So it was kind of a natural choice for me to do so. But with a few caveats, I couldn't study at that time. I knew it. I was conscious of it. I couldn't study the 20th century. I couldn't study the Soviet Union. It was too raw for me. The feelings, and mostly, of course, negative feelings, were too raw and painful. And I knew that to be a historian, of course, you have to be objective. Otherwise, you are a publicist, sort of a public opinion spinner, maybe, or whatever you are, but you are not a historian. And so I decided I will do Russian history, but I'll go into earlier centuries. This is how I started as an early modern Russian historian. And then another thing I thought, you know, I don't want anyone to hold it against me that to say that, oh, yeah, it was easy for you because Russian is your native language. And so, of course, you didn't have to study much the language. It's easier for you. And so this and other consideration, that is the choice of the topics that I chose to study, led me to study also Turkish language and to study the Middle East in general. And that was a very good decision, I could say, in retrospect, and changed my perspectives, my life in many ways, and so on. And this is how I, you know, started my career here continued.
Right. And you've written a number of books on what I refer to as the sort of the edges of the empire. You've written about some ethnic minorities. Do you want to take us through a couple of those books? Because 20th century is very different from your other books, I think.
It is very different indeed, yes. So most of my focus, scholarly focus, was on, as you put it correctly, on the edges, peripheries of the empire. Of course, sometimes it's hard to say what is periphery, what is the center, because 100 years later, what was periphery people regard as the center, such as some central parts of Russia now, let's say along the middle Volga River in Tatarstan or in the North Caucasus, the area called Krasnodar region. If you ask an average Russian, they will say, of course, these are, you know, Russian regions from time immemorial, but of course they were conquered and became Russian in the consciousness of the people only recently, particularly the Krasnodar, North Caucasus area, only in the 19th century after ethnic cleansing, we can call it today definitely, of the region from the indigenous population. So I was always interested in more interested in the Russian Empire as such, but a non-Russian component of the Russian Empire. Because when people mention the Russian Empire, they actually forget that by early 20th century, 56% of the population of the Russian Empire were non-Russians. So ethnic Russians were still an absolute majority. But if you take all other non-Russian peoples together, they were in majority. And so, obviously, you want to understand who these people were and how were they integrated or not into the Russian Empire. And so, my interest was particularly on kind of an Eurasian-Asian frontiers of a Russian Empire. That is, how Russia expanded into what we call today Central Asia, into the Caucasus, into Siberia, not to the west, where today would be Poland or Finland, which were parts of the Russian Empire in the old days, but in this particular areas of south and east. And so my first book was very specific, like typical academic book. It was focused on the Russian state and the Kalmyk people, a peculiar group of people who are Tibetan Buddhists, and they're still a former republic within the Russian Federation today. And in fact, this is where I went to study when I was in college in the Soviet Union, because as a Jew in the 1970s, it was impossible to get into any reasonably well-known central university. So many people like me chose to travel to peripheries because there the issue was more whether you're a Kalmyk belonging to this indigenous group. And if you were not, then you become a Russian. It was not much. It was almost like in the old Soviet joke when there was an advertisement in the newspaper, and it said, "Comrade Jews, if you want to become Russian, immigrate to Israel." So this was pretty much on target.
Oh, that's fantastic.
So this is I went to college. university, which was probably one of the least, how shall I say, to be polite, least developed universities. Uh-huh. It became a university only recently, and it was in a very remote place of Russia. And I spent 5 years there. But anyway, this actually became a very interesting topic of my research, because that's where I turned to do my first dissertation and the book, writing about these people and essentially reframing the entire concept that was at the time was the major historiographic concept in the Soviet Union. That is, that all these peoples were not conquered by Russia, but they voluntarily became subjects of the great and benevolent Russians.
I see.
And it of course sounded already silly and questionable, but one had to show how in fact it was wrong and why it was wrong and so on. And from there I traveled to another, to a more general topic, which I dare say became a classic in Russian historiography today. And that's a book called Russia's Steppe Frontier, The Making of a Colonial Empire from 1500 to 1800s. And that basically was a book that conceptualized the notion of a frontier in Russian history. Just to give you a very quick example to your listeners, I will say this. We know that in American history, in U.S. history, Western frontier is a huge concept, right? It's both a concept and a myth. Without Hollywood, without so much we know about the West, we would be, we know all about this. But what struck me when I began to approach this topics, what struck me that in Russia, there was a similar frontier. There was frontier in the South and Southeast, where Russia faced all these nomadic, semi-nomadic people, such as Kazakhs today, or Kalmyks, or Kyrgyz, or numerous other peoples. It was never conceptualized as such. No one ever thought about it. No one called it as such. It never occupied a role that it should have occupied in Russian historiography. And so I wrote this book, which essentially introduced this notion of similar frontier in Russia. And then I turned my eyes toward a different region to write a book on the history of Russia's conquest of the North Caucasus in the 19th century. And that was the book, was also written in a untypical, unusual historical genre through the eyes of one particular individual. I found information about him in the Russian archives. And he was a fascinating individual because he grew up in Russia as a Russian, will become an officer in the Russian army. But when you start digging deeper, you realize he was also a native. He was a Chechen whose father was given as a hostage to the Russians. And so he grew up in Russia, but he actually spent several years in his father's native village. 4 years there, and he was fluent in Chechen and Arabic and Kumyk, another language of the region, and became an indispensable translator. But he was a witness to the brutality of the Russian conquest on the one hand, as he was a translator and an officer in the army, and at the same time, of course, he understood and had empathy for the people on the other side. And so this is this tormented individual who has dual identity and is trying to decide who he is, in fact. And in the end, he deserted Russian army, not once, but twice. And anyway, those who are interested may read about it. But the point of it is that it allowed me to present the history of the Russian conquest from both sides, from the sides of the indigenous people, how they perceived it, and of course the more traditional side of the Russian Empire. So these were my previous books before I decided to turn to the 20th century, and I can tell you about it more if you're interested. Or
Absolutely, please, because you seem to have made a career of telling history in very unconventional ways. And certainly Russia's 20th century is anything but conventional. How did you come to the format that is works so very well in this book?
Well, thank you. I'm glad if it's worked. Well, first of all, let me mention that I choose different genres because I want to reach a broader audience. It is fine, of course, to write highly scholarly books that are read by your colleagues, 12 people in the field, 20 people in the field, maybe. And it's fine. This is how knowledge is produced. It's incremental, and it's very narrow. But at some point, somebody also has to try to synthesize this and to disseminate it to a larger audience. And so at some point, I was not happy just writing for a small group of colleagues and wanted to reach an educated, curious public. And so I chose different genres to do that. This one was very simple. One day I stopped at the came across a book by a well-known German writer. What's his name?
Günter Grass, I think.
Günter Grass, a good German writer, Nobel Prize winner. Yeah. And the book was called My 20th Century. And this is how he, of course, this was a work of fiction, but this is how he structured it. Every year was a little story, a little different story from different individuals. Most of them were fictional. I mean, they were related to real events, but most of them were fictional. And it occurred to me, I thought, my goodness, why can't I, perhaps I can write a book in this way as well that will capture the history of Russia in the 20th century. And it will not be another sort of a traditional narrative where you discuss what happened in the economy and then what happened in politics and how things developed and so on. There are many of those, and some of them are very good, but do it in a way that, again, a general, intelligent and curious, educated person can reach and say, this is interesting. I never heard of this before, and I learned it. A lot about Russia from a different perspective. So that's how it came about.
And I'm curious, how did you go about choosing the vignettes? Because as you say, some of them are well-known incidents and others are completely new for me. And I think for many of your future readers.
Yes.
What was your methodology?
Methodology was no methodology. Well, I'm being a little sarcastic here. I have to step back and tell you something else. So there was another reason why I chose to write about the 20th century. Some people write autobiographies, and some people choose to do it early on, like our former President Barack Obama. I reached a certain age, I guess, where I look more and more back onto my past, into my own life, and what happened during my 23 years of life in the Soviet Union. And I wanted to look again at the events that I lived through, at the stories with which I grew up. But now, 40 years later or so, as a professional historian, and in some sense, it's a kind of a therapeutic experience of writing something short of autobiography, which I'm not interested in writing at this point, maybe when I am 85, look at my life, but through the eyes of history. And so in some ways, the vignettes that I chose were related to the stories I heard, the stories I grew up with, the events I lived through. For example, there's one story, I think it's 1931, about Pavlik Morozov, this Russian Soviet boy who becomes a hero in the Soviet mythology, right? And what's his virtue? He is essentially betraying his father, who was hoarding grain during the collectivization. The Communist Party tried to put all the peasants into collective farms, and they were expropriating the grain and so on. And he essentially reports his father to the authorities. His father is arrested and eventually sent to camps and executed, dies. And he becomes a hero that the Soviet children are supposed to emulate. And I went to school in Kyiv, where I grew up, the capital of Ukraine, which was right next to a square, a little square, which was called Pavlik Morozov Square, and there was a monument to him. And of course, in the school he was also mentioned and so on. And so I thought, you know, I should write about this. I should mention this because it's hard to imagine for people who are not familiar with either Russian history too well or Russia in general, what does it tell you about the country which tries to drive a wedge between generations within one family and then making it a hero. I mean, this, of course, we have other examples of this cultural revolution in China was similar and so on, but it didn't last as long as Pavlik Morozov remained a hero since 1930s until 1980s when they sort of slowly started rewriting. So things like this, and there were some, I came across various stories that simply are not very well known, such as the nuclear exercise that the Soviets conducted.
Yes, I'm glad you mentioned that because that was a real shock to me.
This was, I'm sorry, but I cannot exactly remember which year was which. So this was 1954. Nuclear war exercise snowball. And essentially, the Soviet party and military officials decided to test whether nuclear weapons could be incorporated into the battlefield. Yeah. And they actually used real nuclear weapons, dropping real nuclear bomb, sending the divisions of Soviet troops into the battlefield and the tanks and so on after that, without telling them that this was a real nuclear weapon. They said it was just a test, and this is fake, and so on. The result was, all of this was, the results were all hidden and kept secret. We still don't know the full data. We do know that several villages had to be evacuated. All the medical records were erased. Some people reported, hundreds of dead bodies of soldiers shipped on the train, but we don't have the exact, there's no archival record of all these events. But just, to think about it, what the government at the time was capable of and what they did and what they thought, this is a story that is very little known, even among Russian historians. So I thought this would be good to talk about.
Absolutely. And I think that theme of the sort of the government's inability to have a concern and a care for its citizens and its willingness to keep secrets from them recurs again and again throughout this book and throughout some of the vignettes. And that's just one of the recurring themes. I think one that really jumps out at one right away and keeps going all the way through is the horrific human cost of this Soviet experiment. It recurring again and again. I think some of the events that stood out for me were the vignette about the Belomor Canal, as well the siege of Leningrad, and also this 1959 census. That's a more dry kind of bureaucratic story, but with horrific numbers. And I wonder, did that sort of occur to you that this was kind of coming up again and again as you put these vignettes together?
Well, not only it occurred to me, this was part of the design, to show the an extraordinary, truly extraordinary by all circumstance, by all measures, human toll of the Soviet experience. Because sometimes, you know, among many colleagues, those particularly on the left, you can hear, less so now, but for many years, you could hear the refrain that, yes, of course, we know that there were victims and Stalinism was bad, but look at the achievements of the Soviet Union. It industrialized, it became a major country, the superpower, it educated its population, and so on and so forth. And I wanted to show essentially and argue with this line of thought and to say that none of this, and this is actually all very questionable, what kind of industrialization, what kind of education, how it was done. But even if we accept it, none of this justifies the enormity of a human tragedy, of a human toll, that the cost at which all of this was done. The numbers are there, the numbers are damning, but it's more than numbers, it's how it affects people. It's how people, what kind of a person emerges from this environment. And it, in the end, actually, I wanted to make sure that somebody who reads it will understand today's Russia better. Because some of the issues that we see today are going all the way back to the Soviet century, particularly after President Putin became a president in the last two decades. In many ways, he is a product of the Soviet Union, one of the worst products in terms of coming from the secret police, from KGB himself, retaining that mentality and now imposing it on the rest of the country in kind of in a more sophisticated way. Many other things that evolved into similar forms, they expressed differently, but they still continuation of that mentality, of that psychology and so on. Just the other day, I can give you an example. Just the other day, the patriarch of the Russian Orthodox Church, that's the highest religious authority, said something interesting. He said, the sin of liberalism lies in the fact that it puts a human being and humanity at the center of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's funny you should mention that. My husband just picked up on that as well. We were talking about that, I think, last night. It's a fascinating, because it gets to the heart of the whole the whole Soviet mentality, but also the fact that Russia misses out on so much of that. You know, yes, the person is at the center. And that comes through as well throughout your book, that the individual is not as important as the whole, as the collective.
Well, it's not just important. It was simply... the role of individual was to sacrifice himself or herself for the glory of the state. And the state, of course, eventually was the power elites, the Communist Party. I mean, that's how they interpreted the state. Just like, what is the state today? You know, the Russian media often trumpets the same theme that, you know, we want Russia to be great, Russia great again in some ways and so on. But what is Russia great? What kind of Russia? It's Putin's Russia and there was a small group that control it.
You know, I think that's right. And I think that throughout the book, there are moments when the reader finds himself just shivering because it's so frightening. And yet there are also moments where you kind of throw it up as almost laughable when the state is just so out of touch with the needs or the desires mm-hmm. of its citizens. I think particularly towards the end in the 80s, we highlight some of those for the readers because I thought they were really well done. And one could sense that you were drawing on some of your own personal experiences there.
Yeah, I mean, the state was always out of touch, and some you can say in some ways, you know, the most this famous Well, it was out of touch. There are two ways to be out of touch. One was out of touch in reality, that is, not realizing truly what's going on. And the other is more dangerous out of touch when it's a cynical out of touch, deliberate out of touch, such as when Stalin pronounces in the middle of the purges, when tens of thousands of people are arrested and executed, and he declares that comrades, life has become better, life has become merrier. This is not just out of touch, not understanding the what's going on. This is the degree of cynicism that is also a line that goes through the entire 20th century into the current situation in Russia that is very dangerous and very disturbing, and particularly disturbing because I see it more and more in today's Russia, in how the Putin's authorities deal with various situations, what they say and what they do. It's an extraordinary degree of cynicism.
Right. And I think that's a good moment to ask you about another theme that runs through the book, which is the struggle of ethnic minorities in general, but you kind of laser in on Ukraine as an ethnic minority that's trying to achieve autonomy throughout the century, and Russia just doggedly refusing to allow that to happen. I think it's very timely, given what we're seeing in the news every night. And I can't resist the temptation not to ask you about how you see what's going on today as an echo of what you explore in the book. Particularly with regard to Ukraine, but also other ethnic minorities that you've been studying.
Well, let me say it first. Your readers probably don't know that the 1936 Constitution, which was the kind of a fundamental basic constitution, which was changed only a little in the next constitution in the 70s, actually gave the republics, the composite republics of the Soviet Union, there were 12 of them at that time, or 11. Eventually, it'll be 15 after World War II. The right for self-determination and the right to secede. And it was done essentially in the climate of the 30s, partly because Stalin wanted to show the West that, you know, we have a great democratic country here. All the complaints about us are not true. And partly, of course, most importantly, because Stalin thought it was just a piece of paper and it doesn't matter. This has no, you know. So many things were put on paper there. The right to, there was a freedom of speech and the freedom of assembly, essentially, in the Soviet Constitution. And, of course, we know that none of this existed in reality. So, ironically, it's this clause that became the legal precedent for the dissolution of the Soviet Union. So in 1991, when the Soviet Union fell apart, it fell apart along this national lines. Out of one country emerged 15 sovereign states. Now, these national issues, this national tension, ethnic tension, was always there. But it was always swept under the rug. And there is a reason why topics like what I described to you in my first book about the relationship between the Russian state and the Kalmyk people in the 17th, 18th century, topics like this essentially were taboos. If you were a Soviet historian and you wanted to work on this in the Soviet archives, you will not be given access to the documents. Because if you read the documents, it will become clear that the official thesis of the Soviet government and the Soviet historians was a friendship of people. The Soviet Union was a family, and they were all friendly to each other, eternal friendship of peoples. But reality was always very different. There was a lot of unsolved problems between different ethnic groups, a lot of hostility that was sort of swept under the rug but never dealt with. And at different times, these things came out, but they were suppressed and repressed. People were arrested in Ukraine, in Georgia, in Azerbaijan. There were always, in Tatarstan, within Russia, there were always nationalist, what we'll call them, nationalist groups and people who wanted more room for their cultural identity. And all of this was seen as a threat to the Soviet regime. So when the 1980s happened and some kind of a liberalization happened under Gorbachev, all these things came to the fore very quickly. And all a lot of ethnic and national tension leading to violence in many regions and in the Caucasus particularly. And the Soviet Union fell apart precisely because of it. So the notion that the Soviet Union was a very complex empire, we can say today definitely, that was composed of so many different ethnic and national groups. I should say probably religious as well, except religion was quite successfully suppressed in most of the cases by throughout the years of Soviet experience. All of this was not studied enough, either certainly not in the Soviet Union and also not in the West. Somehow many Western historians bought into the Soviet line and they studied mostly Russians and they studied the working people, working class and so on. So this was a very important topic. In fact, the key to understanding what was going on in the Soviet Union and why it collapsed. What was the initial question again, Jennifer?
Well, I'm sort of, I see in your book again and again throughout these vignettes, each sort of decade, there's a moment when Ukraine is struggling to receive, to gain a sort of a better autonomy and Russia just absolutely refusing to allow it. I think to a certain extent you've answered the question, but I wanted to dig a little deeper and wonder with you where that refusal of Russia comes from. Why not? If it's all, you know, a great big family, a multi-ethnic, multi-confessional empire, not multi-confessional during the Soviet Union, but where does that reluctance and stubbornness come from?
Okay, so the yes, I got sidetracked a little bit, but not really. I wanted to answer your question by putting it in a larger perspective, because it was not just Ukraine. Georgia was always the same. Was also the same. There was always a strong national movement in Georgia, which Moscow refused to allow to go further. Although the dynamics were there different, and Georgia was in a much better position because the national language was always used and was not discouraged, unlike Ukraine. In the Baltics, the same situation was Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia happened. So Ukraine was only one of in this kind of a general attitude towards non-Russians. But Ukraine was simply more important than other places because after Russia, this was the second largest, both in terms of population, in terms of industrial base. And so on, the second largest republic in the Soviet Union. What is interesting that, you know, once you control everything from the center, as it was done in the Soviet Union, Moscow, Central Committee, Communist Party, everything is decided there. You rely on certain venues of information. And so on the one hand, you can say that the Moscow allowed certain cultural identity in Ukraine to take place. So when I was growing up, there was there were two Ukrainian newspapers that is published in Ukrainian language. There was a Ukrainian radio program. There were schools, not many, minority, but still there were schools in which you can actually study all these subjects in Ukrainian language. And of course, culturally, they were Ukrainian theaters and dance groups and and so on, the choirs. And that was true for all republics. As Stalin said, we want them to be cultural in form, but socialist in content. So that was the attitude, that was the policy. But the question is, as I said, when things are decided in the center, and then somebody reports that, well, there is a growing nationalism here, and they decide to clamp down on this, where is that line? Where is the balance? So on many occasions, they decided in Moscow that there is too much cultural identity in Ukraine now, that there are too many people who are actually who want to speak Ukrainian, and they want more sort of Ukrainian to be more in the center than Russian, and that's dangerous. We need to crack down on this. So, for example, in the 1960s, I discussed this particular case. The head of the Ukrainian Communist Party was his name was Dmytro Shelest, and he built, not far from where I lived, in fact, a palace a big concert hall, and in the Soviet Union they were called palaces. You know, the Bolsheviks reversed everything. The palaces became the palaces for sports, on the palace for wedding, marriages, and so on. Sort of reversing the royal Tsarist palaces into the palaces for the workers and peasants, essentially. So this was called the Palace of, I forgot, something, Palace of the Union, I think it was called. But it was a huge concert hall, assembly hall, and so on. And in Moscow, they decided that this was actually, Shelest tried to compete with Moscow and build the same huge palace as it was in the Kremlin in Moscow. And this and other things indicated that Shelest was growing too autonomous and moving into nationalist direction. So he was fired, of course, under the pretext of ill health and whatnot, and replaced by a more pro-Russian secretary of Communist Party. So things like this, what I'm saying is that Moscow was always concerned because it knew that there was always a nationalist mood among certain groups of the population, and it was always concerned that this may grow and become anti-Soviet or anti-Russian. And for many people, actually, these two meant the same thing. It took time for the Soviets to understand this. So in Ukraine, and of course in Ukraine in particular, the history is goes much further. I mean, there was a strong Ukrainian independence movement beginning at least from the early 20th century. Of course, before that was Shevchenko, the national poet in the 19th century. But after the revolution, Ukraine was independent, sovereign for a very short period of time. I think it was like 7 months or so. And why did they want sovereignty? Because in the late 19th century, early 20th century, there was a particularly strong anti-Ukrainian attitude in Tsarist Russia. Ukrainian language was officially banned. You could not read in Ukrainian. You were not supposed to speak Ukrainian. So there is a long history of repressing Ukrainian identity. When the Bolsheviks came to power, they actually recognized it for a short period of time until late 1930s. And that's why they encouraged national cultural identities among Ukrainians, but among many other peoples. For those who didn't have an identity, they created a written language and so on among smaller peoples. But when then came World War II, and with that, Soviet Union became Russified. Under Stalin, Russification took place again. The Russification that Stalin condemned in the early part when the communists came to power in the 1920s, because remember, Stalin himself was a Georgian, too, of course. So he was aware of this grievances of non-Russians against the Russians throughout the Russian imperial period. And so he condemned Russian Empire, as he called the prison of the peoples, and he condemned Russification. And so throughout the 20s and 30s, this was a period of relative tolerance and encouragement of national identities. But after that, Stalin himself returned to Russification. And again, I talk about it in some of the vignettes, how it happened and why. And I will leave you at that.
It's interesting because throughout the book, there are incidents that kind of echo in decades that are maybe three or four decades removed. And I find that there are, when I went back to read it for a second time, I found a lot of pairings that I hadn't really considered before. I mean, I don't think I'm the first person to liken the fate of Vladimir Mayakovsky with that of Vladimir Vysotsky. But there were other ones that really occurred to me for the first time. And one was the tercentenary celebrations of the Romanovs in 1913. It has a lot of echoes in the Olympic Games of 1980, and then perhaps in the 21st century with the more recent World Cup in 2018. Because I think that it brings that idea that the state is really out of touch, that it's celebrating this big event, but it doesn't really understand what's going on underneath. Are there other pairings that occur to you throughout the book?
Not immediately, Jennifer, not immediately. But I would say, you know, this is interesting that you mentioned this. I would say that there are some big important differences between, let's say, you brought up the 300th anniversary of the Romanov dynasty that was celebrated in 1913. I have a vignette about that. And let's say 1980 Olympics or even more recent soccer championship. The Romanov celebration was, of course, a big celebration. And there were many events staged everywhere, mostly in Petersburg, in the capital, and so on. But it didn't have the same sort of a Soviet quality in the sense that everything was surreal and artificial about the Soviet celebrations, Soviet big events like the Olympics, for example. They cleaned up everything. They expelled all the homeless, whatever homeless people and known thieves were warned not to do anything. Everyone was expelled beyond a certain kilometer of Moscow, that is to the kind of outside of the city. The city was completely cleaned up just for this particular event. They delivered more food to the stores during this particular time. You could buy items in the store like chocolates and bananas that you usually couldn't. And generally the stores were better supplied. So this kind of a showing off, this kind of a what would be called Potemkin village. I don't know your listeners, some of you that may know this. Potemkin village means the, pretending that something exists, creating a facade of something beyond which something actually doesn't exist. So you can clean up the facade of the house that looks very nice, but in fact it's rotting inside. And Potemkin village goes to 18th century Russian history, Prince Potemkin. That is another very typical feature of Russian history that goes throughout the centuries, including the Soviet times. So, and I talk about 1980s, what happened, the extent to which they changed things. Another actually good example was, and I mentioned this, When Nixon visited Kiev in 76 or 75. Nixon was already gone by that. In 1972 it was. He visited Kiev, and I remember it from my own experience. I was taking a trolley to a school. I was in high school, and all of a sudden I look and I see, along the street where there were some old houses, all of a sudden the houses are gone. Those that stayed there were freshly painted. some trees were planted where the houses were. And I thought, am I dreaming? Is something going on? What's going on? And then a couple of hours later, I heard that they announced to the Soviet citizens that President Nixon was visiting Kiev. And I realized what was going on. This was the street, one of the streets along which his cortege was traveling. So to show off that how great Kiev is and how developed it is and how everything is fine, they overnight, practically, they changed the appearances of the streets. And I was shocked at that time. And now I find it amusing. But this was, of course, a typical feature of this Soviet regime that tried to present itself in a way that it was not.
Right. And eventually it just runs out of steam.
Yes, exactly right.
Because you begin to chart, the disintegration. And I thought that you did a really interesting job with the somewhat conflicted character of Boris Yeltsin. I think we're still kind of chewing him over as historians. We're not really sure how to evaluate his brief but very, I think, significant time in government. What did you discover that was new about Yeltsin in putting these vignettes together?
I think I don't think I discovered anything new, quite frankly, but I present him maybe in a light, in a clearer light, because now we have the privilege of looking at more clearly as the time passes by. I think what's remarkable about Yeltsin that he was indeed a revolutionary, a departure from anything else that was in Russia before, in the Soviet Union before. He was a genuine Democrat. He encouraged debates. He believed in multiple voices. He had very different people in his own administration. And that was a tremendous departure from anything else that existed in the Soviet Union or, well, in Russian Empire. By the end of it, maybe it was more diversified, but still a departure from this Russian-Soviet tradition. And again, after he was gone, his heir, unfortunately, Mr. Putin, comes to power and he goes back to the same old traditions and features of the Russian society that we hoped Yeltsin changed, but in fact, of course, he didn't. So Yeltsin was remarkable. He was also a genuine human being, sort of from a large age, and that means with all the flaws that he had. You know, he was a drunkard. He was kind of impulsive person in many ways. But he was a genuine human being because he really genuinely thought about Russian people. There is a moment there, I'm trying to recall, when he comes to the United States and he visits a supermarket in some average-sized town, I think in Houston maybe, an average supermarket. And he looks at the shelves and he sees what's available. And he's genuinely, this is his secretary and translator writes about it later in his memoirs. And he genuinely almost begins to cry and says, look at this. And what we did to our people. How could we do this to our people? And this was a turning point for him, realizing that, no, things cannot continue like this. We need a really break with the past. We need to do something. And this is, again, in sharp contrast to, I would say, to President Putin today, who, of course, the well-being of his own people is not the first thing on his mind. On his mind, the first thing is greatness of Russia, geopolitical strength, which appeals to his own personal instincts, and a great deal of corruption. Of course, the billionaires who are around him who accumulated billions of dollars, that's not about Russian people. You could not say this about Yeltsin. And I don't want to diminish his flaws of all sorts, and I mentioned them, But he was a genuine human being. And I think in part because he comes from Siberia. You know, the Siberians have always been different in Russia. People knew this. Those who had counted Siberians knew this. They were always kind of a people of a bigger soul and a bigger character and more honest, more forthcoming. And he comes from Siberia. I think that has something to do. It was too far from Moscow, too far from all the intrigues. And history of Siberia is different. Of course, serfdom never existed in Siberia, unlike in parts of the Russian Empire. So,
I hadn't considered that. Another thing I hadn't considered that your book has brought to mind. But you don't end happily with this book. You don't leave us with very much optimism at the end of Russia's 20th century. You have this very bleak assessment. You say that Russia was entering the 21st century in the same basic set of principles and values it had maintained throughout the 20th century, which seems very, very pessimistic view, but I think perhaps accurate. You've subjected the previous century to intense scrutiny. What do you think you've learned from doing that?
Well, there are many lessons. It's not pessimistic for the future necessarily. It's actually realistic for where Russia was in the beginning of the 21st century. That is when I attached this description to the arrival of Putin. So that doesn't mean that in 2025. Russia will be the same. It could be a completely different country, or even 2022. I don't know. So I don't have an entirely pessimistic view of Russia. I have a realistic view of Russia in the sense that Putin returned Russia to its past. There's nothing. There's no future for Russia on the path it is now. I mean, if you look at Russia today, what does Russia offer to the rest of the world? China is you can complain about China, and we should in many different ways, but China is an immense economic power. Lots of manufacturing is taking place in China. Lots of capital is in China. Some inventions come from China. I mean, China has a role to play. Russia has absolutely nothing to offer at this point except raw materials, gas, oil, and military. It invests now, these days, it invests a lot in the military. Again, forgetting that this is something that bankrupted the Soviet Union in the first place. And so that is not the future. And everyone knows that, in fact, there are many very talented, very well-educated people in Russia. Russia, for various reasons, the Soviet Union invested in education, particularly in technical education. The joke was that every second person in the Soviet Union is an engineer, and that was almost not an exaggeration. It was an over-industrialized society. But these educational institutions remained. And so there's a lot of potential in Russia. But you look at it and you ask, where is it? And so where is it? Most of the people left. Many people left and preferred to live in Berlin or Riga or U.S. or anywhere, but not to be in Russia because they cannot feel free and in this regime. And those who stay work in very constrained conditions. And so I see quite a bit of potential in Russia, but the political situation it will be not in Putin's Russia. It will be in the new and democratic Russia. And I'm not pessimistic. I think it will happen. The only question is how it will happen. Either it will happen through violence, because people like Mr. Putin do not give power easily, do not retire peacefully. Or it will happen in some kind of a more peaceful transition, for which I hope. All of this remains to be seen. It's very hard to predict. So it's not It's not entirely a pessimistic conclusion, but realistic in the sense that when you look at the past, particularly the rush of the 20th century, it's almost a lesson of not to do and how not to do things. And yet it's being done again. In many ways,
just as
Putin returned
before.
Russia to the past. It's a concern about geopolitics that trumps everything else. At the same time, as the standard of living is dropping, people are not happy. They continue to invest more in the military and trying to become a great power by putting Russian soldiers in Africa and in Syria. I mean, it's a very short-sighted mentality that may appear as a victory for Russia at the moment, but on the long run, it's a recipe for a disaster.
Well, may I ask you, in putting this book together, did you discover anything that was completely new for you about Russian history in the 20th century?
If anything, I would say, it's an interesting question. If anything, it just emphasized to me, to the extent that I was not aware, the enormous tragedy of the peoples and the people who lived in this region. It's hard to describe. I cannot say Russian people because, of course, the Soviet Union was more than just Russian people. There was 300 million of all sorts. So that this territory, that the damage and the damage not only is a poor choice of words here, but not only in death and mortality and the numbers of millions killed for no reason, innocent people, but also the warped mentality and warped human values in many ways. People lived in a society with a constant cognitive dissonance because they lived in a totalitarian society which controlled all aspects of life from the time you were born and went to a kindergarten to the time you die. You had to abide by the Soviet propaganda, say the right things, do the right things, behave in a certain way. And at the same time, certainly by 1960s, it became clear that the Communist Party members live by different standards. They have special stores. They operate differently. It became clear that some people live better than others, even though this was supposed to be a socialist society of full equality. I mean, the mendacity of this political system people who, for the sake of their psychological survival, had to adjust and live with a constantly split personality, all of this has an effect. A long-term effect on people. And so to me, I think it just, the degree to which this Soviet experiment, we can call it, was a, and I'm not talking only about Stalin's regime, but in some ways a crime against humanity, I will even put it this way, in a very broad sense. That to me was a new realization after I finished writing this book.
Wow, that's a big realization, a very big one. Let me ask you, what are you working on now? Because there's always a lag between, you know, when a book comes out and you've finished it months ago.
That's the only thing I know how to do is to write books. If you ask me to nail something to the wall, I won't be able to do it. But I do know how to write books, so that's the only thing I do. But yes, I'm writing a different book, and I return back to my more traditional bailiwick, shall we say, and that is a book on comparative empires. And I will try to suggest that Russia should be understood in the context of the Eurasian empires more so than in the context of European empires. In other words, if we compare Russian Empire with the Ottoman Empire and Persian Empire and Chinese empires, we may understand certain values, political culture, and other things about Russia better than if we compare Russia with France and England.
No, that sounds fascinating. And I'm not sure it's going to win you a whole bunch of friends in Moscow, but certainly I think it will win you lots of devoted fans over here. I think that's an ideal topic to be exploring right now.
Yeah, I'm not trying to win friends anywhere at this point. I do think of myself a historian who has to tell the truth as I see it. People can, of course, can disagree, and that's a whole different matter. That's all debatable. It's perfectly reasonable to debate things. But, of course, no, I'm not trying to win friends and to be invited to Mr. Putin's pet projects in various cities where he tries to entertain broad circles of people, some intellectual, and so on. No, I'm not counting on this. In fact, I wouldn't join it anyway.
So. I think that's probably wise. Listen, tell us, Professor, where people can find you and your books online. Are you on social media?
All the books are on Amazon, of course. One can find them, or one can purchase them from the publisher. But Amazon, if one doesn't have any particular moral objections to Amazon, people have all sorts of views. Then they're all there and available.
And do you maintain a website or social media?
I don't have a website. I have a professional, a web page, you'll call it, on my history department at Loyola University in Chicago.
And of course, people can often find you in the opinion pages of the New York Times, where you write on very compellingly on Russia. I think that's how I first discovered you.
Thank you. Yeah, I also wrote for Wall Street Journal, and that was a very different experience, writing for a more conservative paper. Somehow, sometimes I don't know whether I should even mention it, because when I look at the op-eds of Wall Street Journal, most of the time they are so utterly, utterly to the right, unreasonable, that I am even embarrassed to mention that they published me. But the paper itself is wonderful, but in terms of news, but the opinion pages are sometimes questionable from my point of view. But yes, I did write for the Wall Street Journal. I did write for Chicago Tribune, our local paper, several times. I gave some interviews on public radio and other places. So people can, the easiest way to find me is to send me an email if somebody's interested, at Loyola email address, which is available.
All right. Well, we'll put that in the show notes. And I'm sure people will find this a great addition to the canon on the Soviet century. Again, I think we're still digesting it as the general public, as well as historians. I'm afraid that's all we have time for today, but I want to thank you for this very thoughtful and insightful interview. I will remind listeners that we've been talking to Professor Michael Khodorkovsky of Loyola University about his new book, Russia's 20th Century, A Journey in 100 Histories.
Jennifer, the book is published. Yeah. Before we leave, yeah. I just wanted to say that it's an old, perhaps slightly banal adage, but it is true that the interview is only as good as the interviewer and the questions she or he asks. And I mean it quite seriously. So thank you.
Oh, that's very kind of you. Thank you. Well, I found this a really fascinating read. I think, as I said to you at the beginning of the interview and to the listeners, this is very timely, and it's a great, insightful look at Russia that will ask you to examine the history of the 20th century in a slightly different way. So thank you very much, Professor, for joining us.
Thank you, Jen.
I'm your host, Jennifer Yeremeyeva, and thank you for listening. And I will be back soon with another deep dive with a new author and his or her book. Thanks so much for listening.